Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 18th of March. This week marking the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. John McCain, Dick Cheney are both in Iraq for some of this week, and both Senator Clinton and Senator Obama have been talking about Iraq, and we're welcoming your phone calls this hour. I guess the major question of the hour is what would constitute victory in Iraq? The war has cost billions of dollars. 3,990 members of the U.S. military have died. A number of Iraqis have died. What are the Iraqi policies of the presidential candidates, and what would have to take place in order for there to be political reconciliation in the country? Is that possible? We are going to talk about it this hour of the program. Our guest is Professor Stephen Zunes, professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, and he's also a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. We'll be welcoming phone calls, we always do, and to join the conversation, the number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. You can also send us an email if you'd like to communicate that way, and that number, that address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor Zunes, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Good morning.
How many people thought that this might go on for 5 years? It's obviously going to go on longer than that, but I think most people thought it was going to be much shorter.
A number of us actually thought it could go on indefinitely, despite the severe brutality of Saddam's regime. Most of us who knew about Iraqi history and that region in general recognized that an invasion, occupation by Western powers would not be taken very well, and that there would be resistance. And based on the people in the Bush administration who were planning this, there wasn't a whole lot of confidence they necessarily handled it very well anyway. So I am obviously disappointed and angered and distressed, of course, that things have gone on this long, but I am not surprised.
Mm-hmm. The reports are, and maybe this is one of the reasons that this isn't front and center anymore, that the violence in Iraq is down. Is that a good sign that it's down? Does that mean that it can open the road for political reconciliation?
Well, certainly a good sign that things are down, and it could indeed provide an opening, though there aren't many indications that the Iraqi government has been taking full advantage of the decline in violence. My main concern is that it could be temporary, and that it is not cannot be attributed primarily to the escalation or the so-called surge in U.S. forces. The reason being is that much of the reason for the decline in violence was the decision by the army to have a ceasefire when they found that the inter-Shiite violence was getting neither side very far and was alien, and their demands within the Shiite community that it stop. And similarly, the decision, which was actually made several months before the surge, by Sunni tribal leaders in Anbar and elsewhere, that it was worth making an alliance of convenience with the United States to try to get rid of the Al-Qaeda forces, many of whom were foreigners, which had been intimidating anyone who did not support them, were imposing a Taliban-type Islamic rule in areas where they controlled, and was generally causing a lot of problems in their area. But they were, of course, part of the armed resistance against the United States beforehand, as well as the Shiite-dominated government in Baghdad. And there's little indication that they won't, once the Al-Qaeda threat is out of the way, switch back and take on U.S. forces and the Iraqi government, particularly since the Iraqi government is essentially ruled out, including them in any kind of grand coalition government.
Mm-hmm. Senator McCain yesterday, it was obviously front and center in the presidential campaign, perhaps because it's the fifth anniversary, but Senator McCain from Baghdad was talking about Senator Clinton's plan to begin withdrawal in 60 days. His comment, I just think what that means is Al-Qaeda wins.
Well, that seems rather bizarre. For one thing, Al-Qaeda has always been only a tiny percentage of the armed opposition less than 10% by most estimates, and they're in worse shape now, obviously, because of the Sunni councils, turning their guns on them and denying them the sanctuary and support they had. So how this could possibly benefit Al-Qaeda is a real stretch, and whether it will somehow benefit the insurgency in general, that seems rather dubious as well, in large part because the insurgency has been a direct reaction of the ongoing U.S. military presence and aggressive counterinsurgency strategies, which have led to, despite best efforts of most of our armed forces to avoid civilian casualties, has resulted in a lot of damage to civilian infrastructure and civilian deaths, and in a tribal society where vengeance is a strong ethic, has ended up creating insurgents faster than we can kill them.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way for us to help find an Iraqi solution to this?
It's tricky because it's a very complicated political situation, and I think it will really. Ultimately, it is up to the Iraqis themselves. I think what really needs to happen is to bring in a true international diplomatic effort involving the Arab League, involving other regional powers, including, unfortunately, Iran, and as well as the United Nations, to knock some heads together, try to bring things forward. But and unfortunately, the whatever U.S. efforts on this regard have taken place really have not seemed to bring the parties together, and the political situation is still far from resolution. As long as the political situation is not resolved, I don't think any kind of military strategy is going to work.
Mm-hmm. What did you think that all the presidential candidates were talking about Iraq yesterday and will continue to do so, other than talking about race issues? It's going to be quite a week. But what did you make of of their comments, particularly Senator Clinton's comments yesterday in Washington? She's in a dicey position because she voted to authorize the war, but she really is laying out a plan here now to begin withdrawing troops within 60 days. She's taken on this issue front and center.
It's rather a remarkable transition because as recently as 16 months ago, she was defending the war and defending her vote to authorize the war. She was objecting to those who were calling for a withdrawal of American forces. And so to take such a strong position in terms of calling for the gradual withdrawal of combat troops is quite a shift on her part. And of course, there's debate about as to whether how sincere a conversion this was, or whether it was after public opinion polls showed that no pro-war Democrat would have any hope of getting the nomination. I mean, that question is debatable, but there's no question that her speech at George Washington University yesterday did spell out a plan to disengage a large number of American forces from their active involvement. At the same time, it was unclear that she there was no real timetable per se. I mean, she talked about withdrawing individual brigades over a period, but how she was vague about how many troops she would have left. I mean, Barack Obama, who's had the strongest and most consistent anti-war position, even he has recognized that there may be a need to have some kind of special forces operations to go after terrorist cells to protect the green zone, that sort of thing. But by most estimates, his plans would lead to maybe at most 5,000 troops in Iraq, whereas Clinton's plans a little more grandiose, so she's refused to give numbers. Most estimates I've seen have been anywhere between 40 and 60,000 troops under her plan, which is obviously more so than Obama. But in any case, it's interesting that the debate has gone to where it has, that the issue is how many troops to withdraw, not whether to stay the course.
Right. And what about McCain? What plan will he give us and it seems to me as though if he wants to stand a chance here, he's got to have a plan that's different than the Bush administration plan. What is it?
McCain's?
Yes.
Yeah. It's, if anything, it is actually to increase the strength of the military and engagement there. I think he would be much more, you know, hands-on in terms of directing the process. I think he'd probably be a little smarter, at least on a tactical level, than under the current leadership. But the overall vision pretty much seems the same. That does emphasize the military component. There is also concern that he may be even more aggressive in terms of going after pro-Iranian elements, and even Iran itself. He has, like the Bush administration, exaggerated the role of Iran in the current situation there. And so for those of us who have been reticent and have had concerns about the conduct of the war by U.S. forces, there's little reason to feel much comfort in a McCain presidency in terms of handling the situation much better.
Mm-hmm. And what about the American people? What about us? Why is it that this is not an issue that we're seeing every night on the news that we're talking about, and we haven't talked about this issue for some time either? Why aren't we?
Many Americans are frankly tired of hearing about it. It's depressing. Mm. We don't like to think about it. And I think the fact that U.S. Casualties are down, or at least for the time being, has made it less of an issue. I think the fact that the economy is sinking into a recession has certainly distracted people's attention as well. But the violence does continue. The issues are still unresolved, and it still, I believe, should be front and center, frankly, in the presidential race, because what this involves is not just what do we do to get out of the current mess in Iraq, but what was the process that led us to this tragic decision in the first place? Does the United States, as Senators McCain and Clinton argue, have the right to invade a country on the far side of the world that is no threat to us at the time and circumstances of the president's choosing? This is a direct violation of the United Nations Charter, which is a signed and ratified a treaty, according to Article 6 of the Constitution, should be considered supreme law of the United States. This was a war that virtually everybody who was familiar with the region warned would be a disaster. But Senators McCain and Clinton believe that we should go ahead and invade anyway. And I think that there is a one need not be an Obama partisan to really argue that this says a lot about somebody's judgment. It says a lot about it says a lot about the qualifications of somebody becoming president, particularly since both Senators McCain and Clinton have made a similar bellicose comments vis-a-vis Iran, and both of them, as recently as a few months ago, were claiming that Iran had an active nuclear weapons program, just as they were claiming falsely that Iraq had an active nuclear weapons program, whereas in the case of Iraq, the International Atomic Energy Agency had declared some years earlier that Iran no longer had an active nuclear weapons program, something which was confirmed subsequently by our own national intelligence estimates. So I am frankly disappointed that there has not been more focus on the war and its consequences.
Mm-hmm. And the amount of money that we have spent is just phenomenal, isn't it, Professor Zunz?
Oh, very much so. I mean, we're talking, even if we are able to wind things down the next few months, that if you count things like the veterans' benefits and interest on the national debt and everything, we're talking at least $3 trillion.
Oh, my gosh.
$3 trillion. And one can only imagine what this would mean in terms of health care, education, fighting global warming and other environmental threats, public transportation, housing. It just really, really staggers the mind. And as a result, as the economy becomes more front and center in the campaign, we really cannot separate this from the decision to go to war in Iraq, because there's little question that the war, not necessarily the cause of the recession, has certainly contributed to it. It certainly contributed to the fall of the dollar overseas. And it has made it more and more difficult for the government to have the resources that are needed to help people out in what are going to be some difficult times ahead.
Well, welcome, Phone Calls. Our guest this hour is Professor Stephen Zunes, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco. He's a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus, and we're talking this week. We mark the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Our number, 800-486-8655, if you'd like to send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we will be speaking with the editor of Washington Monthly. Their cover story this month is on torture, and it is titled, No Torture, No Exceptions. Iraq This Hour. Professor Stephen Zunes, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco, is our guest, and we go to your phone calls, starting with Adam from Vilas County. Hi, Adam.
Hi, good morning.
Hello.
Hello, yes?
Go right ahead.
Yeah. First of all, thank you for having this program. I've just been bewildered by the lack of coverage lately, and thank your guest. I have two short related questions. The first is a very important topic that he hasn't mentioned so far, and that is the peace of the dead. And without being a Cassandra, ancient Greek doomsayer, isn't it true, according to the published maps in the New York Times, for example, that almost all of the mixed areas of Iraq, both countryside and cities especially, have been purged to one group or the other? And so, therefore, of course, there's less fighting or less civil war type stuff because you've driven out all of the people who used to be in the neighborhood. And this isn't talked about at all, but it slinks to a second issue, which isn't part of this piece. Also, the fact that you've got 1.5 million displaced people inside the country and 2 million outside the country who obviously would disagree with some of the arrangements now. And this leads to the final point, which is what's the U.S. doing? If, in fact, you talk about political reconciliation, what happens, the most likely scenario, is that there'll be a tripartite division of the country, de facto three huge regions and a very weak central government. The United States wants this kind of a thing, they might as well pull out now because that's, in fact, what's going to happen. So are the U.S. politicians saying that we intend to prevent this, whether or not the Iraqis themselves are willing to have a de facto division of their country?
Professor Zunes.
Well, the first two comments, I think, are very well taken, that indeed there has been systematic ethnic cleansing. And one of the major roles of U.S. Forces right now, frankly, are to are setting up these barriers, these walls, separating one neighborhood from another, and guarding the entrances and exits and the like. And though that led to a decrease in casualties, it could hardly be seen as progress or a good thing overall. I personally do not support the idea of partition, and I think most Iraqis do not either. What's interesting is that it is less of a Shiite versus a Sunni fight as it is nationalist within the both communities versus separatist within both communities. And the Kurds are pretty strongly separatist. That's when they're the one group that's united on that front, but they agree to at least formally still be part of Iraq, though for all intents and purposes they're an independent state now. But the problem, of course, is where do you draw the lines? That there are a lot of mixed marriages between all three groups, particularly between Shiite and Sunni Arabs. You have the lines of where people live are not exact. The question of what do you do about Iraqis who are part of neither community, like Turkmen or Syrian Christians or other Christian groups. They have, in the most ethnically pure of the three areas, the Kurdish region, these minorities have been subject to some intimidation and persecution. What happens, of course, and this could be a very big issue, especially around Kirkuk, is what do you do in areas where there are vast natural underground resources near where you're going to draw the line? Where do you draw the line? And obviously that could be a point of contention and great violence in the future. So I think partition would cause more problems than it would solve. And I think most American policymakers recognize it. There's some like Joe Biden, senator who heads the Foreign Relations Committee, who has been pushing this idea somewhat. The original idea when the U.S. invaded was to set up a loose federal system that with a weak central government, in part to try to prevent another strong man like Saddam Hussein from emerging, and in part, some people would argue, as a policy of divide and rule, of not wanting to have any kind of strong nationalist leadership in this large and important Arab country. But America was open to some separate identity. I don't think there was any idea that things would get as out of hand as they have and create the kind of violence and stability that these divisions have created.
And thank you very much, Adam, for the call. Let's talk just a little bit more about all these people who have been displaced, the 2 million outside the country, 1.5 million people inside the country. I had seen reports a few months ago, Professor Zunes, that some of the people outside the country have found it safe enough to return. Is there truth in that? Are they returning?
Actually, in most cases, they are forced to return by the Syrian and Jordanian governments. And many of them are in refugee camps just over the border. They are, or I guess they are technically displacement camps, since refugee is usually a term reserved for people who are outside the boundaries. But for all intents and purposes, they remain refugees. And when they've resettled, it's generally been in these newly ethnically pure neighborhoods, not necessarily where they came from originally. And then, of course, it raises a tricky question that they're dealing with in Bosnia and other places, is that, if you're thrown out of your house, does someone who is thrown out of their house therefore have the right to it, or do you have the right to go back? And if so, if it's not safe for them to return to their home? Mm-hmm. What do you do then? Do you create another displaced person? It's a really messy situation, and the statistics about returning refugees, I think, should not be interpreted that things have gotten better.
Lorene from Wisconsin Rapids, hi.
Hi, I was wondering if the guest could comment on media control as being one of the reasons why the war isn't being reported as much as it should be. And then, to address the question why more people are not involved and crying out against the war, is I have this extreme feeling of powerlessness. Mm-hmm. Because of what I think is going on politically with respect to oil and big business. Mm-hmm. So I'm just like, short of running to Canada with my son, what else can I do,
I understand the frustration. I don't think it's as much a matter of media control in the sense of overt censorship and the like, but most of the commercial media is driven by the bottom line, and they want to have news that people are willing to read, and I think because people are so depressed about the Iraqi situation, people don't want to read it, so they try to give attention to whatever is in the news, whether it be about the latest celebrity scandal or anything else, because it sells more, quite mm-hmm. frankly. And so I think I don't see it as a conspiratorial thing, as it is the fact that our media is largely driven by advertising, and advertising revenue is related to sales, and that's related to having news people want to read. And people don't want to read about Iraq anymore, and I think that's very unfortunate, but that's a piece of the reality. I think in terms of why there isn't more of a movement right now is that I think people are unclear as to really what can and should be done. For example, and back in Vietnam, we could easily say out now, and the worst that could happen was that the communists would win, which they did eventually. And while Vietnam has been under a terrible dictatorship since then, it was no worse than the dictators we were supporting in Saigon in terms of human rights and everything. And at least it brought peace and stability to the country. We cannot say that U.S. withdrawal from Iraq is going to bring peace and security to the country. There are at least 47 different armed groups vying for control. We don't have something the equivalent of the National Liberation Front or North Vietnam to hold things together. And so it's whatever scenario that one can think of, it's going to be a mess. And so I think in many ways it's made people unclear exactly as to what to demand. And so I think people are also, frankly, very, very frustrated that despite the huge protests prior to the war, that the politicians didn't listen, and that the politicians that supported the war and told these untruths about weapons of mass destruction got reelected. I mean, the Democrats even nominated two pro-war people as their candidates for president and vice president in 2004, so there really wasn't much of a choice there. It was like 1968, you know, when both parties nominated pro-war, pro-Vietnam War candidates then. And so I think there's a degree of cynicism and frustration that has made it difficult, along with the very difficult choices in general, to inspire people to take to the streets and demand an end to the war, or at least an end of U.S. involvement in the war. Obviously, again, this is part of the problem. The war will continue in any case.
Mm-hmm. And going back to the press for just a moment, we've heard from a lot of people who are journalists, some of whom have, you know, tried to report from Iraq, that this may be one of the more dangerous wars that we've ever engaged in for reporters. And as a result, we're paying Iraqis who need the money more to do some of the reporting for us because of the danger here. Perhaps if reporters were able to really cover this war and we saw it on television, I don't know if there'd be different policy or not, but maybe we're not getting a full coverage.
Yeah, certainly there's the logistics that it is physically unsafe, and the statistics in terms of the numbers of journalists killed attest to that fact. And I think as a result, people rely on rumors they hear at the bar, the Al Rashid, and dispatches from Iraqi stringers, many of whom are very, very competent, but are not quite the same as having the American reporters and other foreign reporters directly engaged. And so certainly the that practical reality has made coverage less thorough than otherwise would be.
Lorraine, thanks very much for the call. We go to William from Madison next. Hi, William.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A couple of quick things on the media. You just mentioned if we had our own reporters there, we still wouldn't see it on television because this is a policy that they kind of sanitize the violence, and it doesn't sell to see, dying children on TV. So we wouldn't ever see that anyway. Another thing about what we're not hearing in the media is, no, I don't think anybody wants to hear yet again about body counts or divisions of ethnic peoples we don't really understand. But if the media focused on what you talked about before, which is the impact on our economy and our place in the world and our culture, in a serious way, if a conversation included those, real and complex components, that I think we would respond to that. But I don't see that happening. I called to ask to see if the professor knows of or if anybody has floated the idea of setting up some kind of massive reparation fund and extracting ourselves economically from the region as a show of repentance and good faith. Not that America will necessarily do this, but has anyone posited the idea in a think tank and said, well, what if we gave a couple $100 billion into some kind of fund for health and education and infrastructure and refused to take any contracts? America extracted itself completely, could take no financial benefit from this region, that might actually be the most self-preservatory thing we might do going forward. And
Antonio Juhas and some other folks at the Institute for Policy Studies, I know, have done something to this effect, and I've seen talk of similar proposals before. I mean, even those of us who talk about disengagement argue that the United States does have a certain moral obligation, given the extreme damage that we have done to that country. But unfortunately, most of the so-called reconstruction has been to high-priced American contractors doing jobs that Iraqis themselves are quite capable of doing. I mean, even under the strict sanctions and the much heavier bombing in 1991, the Iraqis had their electricity and water up and running within a few months, at least in the Baghdad area. And here we are 5 years later, And in the U.S., led Reconstruction effort hasn't been able to do that. So, Iraq is a huge skilled workforce. They do have the capabilities of rebuilding their own country if there was the stability and the financial resources that would allow them to do so. I think certainly any such a fund would need to be under some kind of international mandate. So in other words, it would not be used by a single government like the United States to give to favored contractors like Halliburton or to reconstruct on grounds that are based on ideology, such as setting up a neoliberal economic system or whatever, but based on the human needs there. At the same time, given the level of corruption in the current Iraqi regime, you wouldn't want just to hand a chunk of money over to them either. So clearly some kind of international body through the United Nations or some other source would need to be ultimately responsible. But I think certainly the United States does have a certain moral obligation to be a major contributor to such a fund. And I think that one of the many stupid mistakes the United States did, frankly, was that in bringing in these high-priced, politically connected contractors, instead of using Iraqi labor, you had a lot of unemployed young men who were natural recruits for these various militias. If they had jobs that could support their families, mm-hmm. They would have a stake in creating a stable country and would be less prone to take up arms and join a militia. Mm.
An email, Ray, from Stevens Point. Obama has repeatedly said we must deal with the mindset that got us into Iraq. Why has there been no follow-through? Perhaps because McCain says we must forget how we got into Iraq and simply deal only with its future. How does the past present itself to us here and now?
It's a tricky one. I think that... there really needs to be some serious accountability about how we got into Iraq, and including the misinformation. If you look at the arms control journals, Arms Control Today, Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, others that came out in the months and years prior to the invasion, there was quite a bit of evidence to suggest that Iraq had achieved at least qualitative disarmament. The former head weapons inspector for the United Nations, who actually was the guy in charge of looking for hidden materials, Scott Ritter, had reported that as far as he could tell, Iraq had gotten rid of any kind of deployable WMDs. Based on these and other reports, I wrote a number of published articles that said the same thing as did quite a few other folks. And so this idea that you have people from McCain and Bush to Hillary Clinton, and Bob Caston saying, we didn't know, they had no way of knowing that Iraq didn't have these weapons. That's totally false. There was plenty of information out there that challenged these claims by these Iraqi exiles that there are these supposed stockpiles of weapons and the like. And so I think there really needs to be an investigation. There are clearly people lied somewhere. And clearly people that should have taken the responsibility, and I'm talking about both the required oversight in Congress, as well as much of the mainstream media, should have looked more carefully at these claims by the Bush administration. So I think that's certainly one area that deserves to be looked at. And I think also this idea that the way to deal with threats of nonproliferation is by invading countries is really a non-starter. If you look at UN Security Council Resolution 687, the violations of alleged violations of which the Bush administration tried to use as justification for the invasion, they talk about disarming Iraq's WMDs within the context of regional disarmament. And there have been calls from countries throughout the region, U.S. allies like Jordan and Egypt, as well as more adversarial regimes like Syria and Iran, calling for the establishment of a weapons of mass destruction-free zone for the entire Middle East and Southwest Asia. Mm. And the U.S. has rejected this because we think our allies, like Pakistan and Israel and others, should be able to have these weapons, and we should be able to bring tactical nuclear weapons on our battleship, on our ships, and our planes, And basically, we have this attitude that we get to unilaterally decide who gets to have these kind of weapons and who doesn't. But if you try, as even putting aside some of the legal and moral questions about that perspective, it's simply unworkable, because whenever you try to impose a regime from the outside that says, of haves and have-nots, it just makes the have-nots want to try even harder to become the haves, to develop these kinds of weapons as a deterrent.
John from Appleton, hi.
Yes. Earlier, the question was phrased, what does it mean to say that we will win the war? And I think the problem is, well, twofold. One is that we do know what it means to lose the war, as we were putting it these days, and which is to say if we leave, then we're admitting we've lost. But I would say rather that, well, we won the war the first month. What we have had since then is an occupation, and that puts the question differently. To win the occupation is to leave. Or alternatively, if you have a more aggressive definition of winning the occupation, it's setting up a puppet colonial government that, you know, allows us to give all the reconstruction contracts to the Americans and to have the American companies do the exploration and production of the oil and everything. And I think it's important to start referring to what we have as an occupation, simply to get away from this, we can't leave because we're that admits that we're losing. I think the only leverage we still have there is to announce a timetable, heaven forbid that we bring that word up again, and so that the people there know that they are going to have to either work this out in some peaceful way quickly, or that all heck will break loose.
Professor Zins.
Strictly legally speaking, it has not been an occupation since the Iraqi government formally came to power in the summer of 2004, but in all intents and purposes, it is. The very fact that, for example, Americans, both military and civilians, have extraterritorial rights, and no Iraqi court can prosecute them for any crime, no matter how severe. The fact that the United States has dictated a number of new laws against the wishes of the majority of Iraqis, including unlimited foreign ownership of Iraqi companies, 100% repatriation of profits, 15% flat tax, this very radical neoliberal program. The fact that U.S. troops can operate and do things without permission of the government inside its territory. I mean, these are really all hallmarks of an occupying power, and again, that is really what's driving the ongoing conflict. The U.S. did have a very clear and very well executed military victory in ousting Saddam Hussein, and so that part indeed has been over. But it's been the reaction of what's happened since then, which has gotten us into this mess. The original idea of victory by the Bush administration was to have a stable, compliant regime where the United States could set up to 14 military bases and sort of be the center of our operations in that region, not just to have effective control of Iraqi oil, but to be on the borders of the world's other major oil producers. And I think there was an idea that the government would be somewhat democratic, but largely compliant to American demands. At this point, though, we're just holding on desperately to make sure that things don't get even worse, and that the level of violence would be at some kind of acceptable rate, whatever people define in Washington define that as being, and to have at least a couple of permanent bases, if not the sprawling complex we originally wanted, but basically just to keep the lid on, but even that is something that will have to be maintained by an ongoing military presence. So under the current policy, John McCain wasn't exaggerating when he said we could be there 100 years, because I think there's going to be ongoing resistance as the British and French and other colonial powers in that area experienced in earlier decades, that it's going to could be a low-level conflict going on for decades at this point.
Professor Stephen Zunes is our guest this hour. We're talking about Iraq. He's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of California and a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. We have one line. Thanks, John, for your call. We have one line open if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655, 414-227-2050 if you're in Milwaukee, or you could send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, the use of torture by the United States. We'll talk with the editor of Washington Monthly. They have devoted their entire magazine for the month of March to this issue, No Torture, No Exceptions. It's Iraq this hour, and Professor Stephen Zunes is our guest. 800-486-8655 is our number. Amy from Madison, hi.
Hi, welcome back, Kathleen. We missed you.
Thanks, Amy.
I wanted to make another comment about the media. I wondered if the professor was aware of a conference that's going on right now in Silver Springs, Maryland, called the Winter Soldier. It's Iraq war veterans speaking out about their many tours of duty and what's going on in Iraq and about their opposition to the war. And as I understand it, the mainstream media is not covering this. The mainstream media that loves our soldiers and is so patriotic is not covering this. I have seen it on television covered by Amy Goodman's Democracy Now! Program. People would be outraged in 5 minutes if they could hear what these soldiers were saying about killing civilians, about no rules of engagement, about torture, about all of the racism against Arabs, all of this coming from the top down, not going from the bottom up. It is outrageous that the mainstream media is not covering this. We're getting firsthand accounts from soldiers who have been there for, say, three tours of duty, some of them volunteering and not being able to stand what is going on there anymore.
I've been following the hearings based on a couple of listservs that I'm on, but I have not seen any coverage in the mainstream media either, which is real tragic because these are people who really know what it's all about. You know, they have been there. They've been on the ground. And I think in particular they have challenged the Pentagon's line that the occasional atrocity we hear about is just the result of a few bad apples or exceptions. And in fact, as is inevitable in a kind of counterinsurgency war such as this, that the killings of civilians is widespread. And it is not something that is seen as something worth holding people accountable for. Now, I can understand the soldier's perspective. You know, when you see something in the corner of your eye, and if you hesitate, you or your buddy could be killed. If you don't hesitate, you end up shooting some 12-year-old kid, you know, peering over his garden wall. But that, you know, this kind of thing is happening constantly in Iraq, and it is this sort of thing that it's important to know, not just on a moral level, that you know that this is, you know, that our tax dollars are supporting widespread killings of civilians, but this is also what is fueling the insurgency as people try to seek revenge for the death of loved ones, and it's also something that the veterans are having to deal with psychologically, because virtually every study I've seen of post-traumatic stress is that it's less about fear of yourself being killed, but the guilt and related emotions of killing. And you know, we know the impact that this had on our Vietnam vets. In fact, the term Winter Soldier came from similar hearings that took place by Vietnam veterans. And so this is something that really does deserve a lot more attention than it's been getting. And I share your disappointment that it has not been getting the mainstream media coverage that it deserves.
Thank you, Amy, very much for your call. Email from Wendy of Marshfield. What are the plans of the candidates for when the troops are withdrawing and afterward?
The plans of the
presidential candidates.
McCain is not talking about withdrawal of troops anytime soon. And in terms of the two Democrats, Barack has promised to get the soldiers out, the combat units, those who are engaged in active offensive military operations, out within 16 months. though you know, he remains open, like any commander-in-chief would, in terms of if there are some specific circumstances on the ground where generals convinced him of altering that somewhat, he'd be open to that. But he does have a timetable that he has stated that he's going to really try to make. And Senator Clinton has also called for the withdrawal of active combat units, though her timetable is less clear, and the plans post the withdrawal of the majority of forces are a little more ambitious in Clinton's side than Obama's, but though both acknowledge that the U.S. will be engaged in a long time, and neither has a promise to have all troops out by the end of their first term in 2013. Obama puts a little more emphasis on, in terms of a quick reaction force, say to root out a particular terrorist cell or some other kind of security situations where the Iraqis were unable or unwilling to take it on, that such forces would be more over the horizon, such as in Kuwait or some allied force, rather than be in Iraq itself. But in any case, there is going to be at least low-level engagement for some time. But it does appear that both Democrats are willing to get the bulk of the combat forces out, within a couple of years of coming to office. And given and even if one wants to question their sincerity on this, I think the fact that their constituencies are so adamant at this point, it's pretty hard for either of them to get away with not doing so.
We go to Rick from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. I'd like to ask Professor Zunis what he thinks the significance is of the recent visit of the Iranian president to Iraq, and doesn't it present an opportunity for wider Middle East peace? And isn't it a shame that our Vice President Dick Cheney is now in Iraq, but he won't get on a plane and fly a couple hundred miles into Iran to meet with the leaders of Iran to talk about diplomatic connections for that wider Middle Eastern peace?
Well, the significance of President Ahmadinejad's visit, I think, is just that Iran, thanks to the U.S. invasion, has enormous influence in that country, that the ruling coalition in Baghdad spent their exile years in Iran. Askeri, for example, was recognized as the government exile by the mullahs in Iran, the Badr Brigade, their militia, which constitutes the bulk of the Iraqi army, was trained originally by and formed, in fact, by the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And so there's when we talk about Iranian interference in Iran, it's not to supporting the insurgency, certainly not the Sunni insurgents, which are the 90% responsible for 90% of the U.S. casualties, but they're supporting the same people we are, the Iranian government, actually the Iraqi government. And so so for better or worse, if we're interested in the future of Iraq, we're going to have to deal with Iran. We're going to have to talk with them. And certainly, Iran has its interests in a number of elements within the Iranian government, are certainly, in my view, up to no good, and wanting to manipulate certain factions that might support their particular faction. It's problematic, to be sure, but it's certainly something that deserves to be talked about within part of a regional context. So, Barack Obama has been talking specifically about bringing in regional leaders to try to work things out, since the Iranians and the Saudis and others have their particular factions they're supporting, and we are going to have to deal whether we like it or not. I mean, we were largely responsible for giving the Iranians this influence, and certainly just giving threats to attack them because of this influence is not going to bring the process forward, but it's going to take some very tough negotiations. And I should also mention that the Iraqis are nationalists, even the Shiites. I mean, they're not puppets of Iran or the United States or anybody else. I mean, they have their own interests as well. And I think we need to emphasize the right of true self-determination. And so in bringing in parties to negotiate and figure out a political settlement, this does not mean dividing up spheres of influence. This means giving the Iraqis the true right of self-determination, self-governance.
And thanks very much for the call. I wish we had time for more phone calls and more emails, but we don't. I thank you so much, Professor, for being with us again.
My pleasure.
Our guest this hour, Professor Stephen Zunes, Professor of Politics and International Studies at the University of San Francisco. He's a contributor to Foreign Policy in Focus. And we, of course, marking the fifth anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and spending this hour talking about the war, the casualties, the way forward, if there is a way forward, the authorization for the war, which I believe was 5 years ago tomorrow, wasn't it? Isn't that the exact day? And also looking at the presidential plans of the three candidates, where they would go from here. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee for all your calls and interest in this topic. We thank you as well and promise that we will be on the issue more in the upcoming weeks. We have news coming up from National Public Radio, and then we'll return with another hour of Tuesday morning conversation as we look at a defining issue of our times, the issue of torture. So all of that is coming up. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.